Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Mark Lobel, and in the early hours of Friday, the 2nd of August, these are our main stories. Donald Trump has announced that the US will impose fresh tariffs on another $300 billion worth of Chinese products, despite also tweeting that trade talks had been constructive. Women in Saudi Arabia are for the first time being given the right to travel abroad without a male guardian's permission. A former president of the Sporting Lisbon Football Club in Portugal is to face trial, accused of organising a violent attack on his own players after a string of bad results. Also in this podcast,
Khadija Mellor now coming through to Khan take up the running. Can she push this out to victory?
A teenager has become the first person in the UK to appear in a competitive horse race while wearing a hijab. President Trump has announced new tariffs on China as the latest move in the escalating trade war between the two countries. Speaking to reporters outside the White House, Mr. Trump outlined the level of tariffs he wants to add to billions of dollars worth of Chinese goods.
The 10% is for a short-term period, and then I can always do much more or I can do less, depending on what happens with respect to a deal. But I'm very happy the way it is right now.
Jonathan Josephs from our business unit told me more about how the tariffs, which would apply to many popular, everyday items and kick in from September, would work.
These would apply to, he said, $300 billion worth of goods at a rate of 10%. Now, that's $300 billion worth of goods that aren't currently subject to tariffs. At the moment, we've got tariffs on $250 billion worth of goods that come into the US from China, and those are at 25%. So these new tariffs would affect much more everyday things, things that consumers buy in the shops, things like smartphones, toys, clothes, footwear. And it comes at a time when retailers are stocking up for the holiday season with Thanksgiving and Christmas on their minds. So it looks like prices will increase for consumers for that period.
Donald Trump seems to be using this to try and force a trade deal with China. But the impact it's having already on investors and on people who are trading at the moment is quite stark.
Absolutely. We saw a pretty immediate reaction on the financial markets in New York, all the major indices falling because they weren't expecting this. We just had hope of progress in these talks with a latest round of negotiations between the US and China happening in Shanghai this week. And both sides agreed that that was constructive. So this is a bit of a shock to the system. Retail and industry groups are saying this is really bad. This is going to hurt the US consumer most of all. That's something President Trump, it should be said, disputes.
Both sides are still engaging to deliver a deal. What are the sticking points?
At the moment, we've got the next round of talks scheduled for September in Washington. Remains to be seen whether China will want to go ahead with those talks with this gun to their head, so to speak, because even before these latest tariffs were announced, they were asking President Trump and the US to remove the tariffs that already existed. But for the US side, the same things remain. I mean, President Trump has spoken about the need for China to clamp down on fentanyl being sent from China to the US. This is an opioid which is being blamed for many deaths in America. But what he really wants is the trade deficit to fall. That's the gap between what America buys from China and what it sells. At the moment, America buys a lot more from China than it sells. So money is, according to President Trump, in effect, going out of the US to China. He also wants better protection for the intellectual property rights of American companies.
Briefly, has Donald Trump's latest move made a trade deal more or less likely?
I would say it makes it less likely that we're going to get anything in the short term and that this becomes a much longer term problem.
Jonathan Josephs with that analysis of Donald Trump's latest salvo in an ongoing trade war. Saudi Arabia has announced a new law that would allow women to travel abroad without a male guardian's permission, ending a restriction that has been a symbol of the kingdom's ultra-conservative rule. David Bamford reports.
The new law was published in the Saudi Official Gazette at midnight local time. It says that Saudi women over the age of 21 will be able to apply for a passport and travel outside the country. The change would put them on an equal footing with men. They will also be able to register births and deaths, a right previously restricted to men. The development comes at a time of increased international scrutiny of women's status in Saudi Arabia. In recent months, several young women have fled the country and made public pleas for help in seeking asylum from their family and the government.
David Bamford. Now, how seriously should we take the Syrian government's latest announcement of a ceasefire in Idlib province after all the bitter fighting there? Over the past 3 months, the northwestern region has been the scene of fierce fighting. The UN says nearly 500 civilians have been killed in attacks by government forces and their Russian allies, whom they have accused of a scorched earth policy there. More details from our Middle East analyst, Alan Johnston.
The government has agreed to an almost immediate truce, a ceasefire that should go into effect tonight, but it is conditional on the opposition fighters pulling back from frontline areas. And it's clear that the Syrian government seems to be saying that it wants the implementation of a deal that was originally struck a year ago. And this was an arrangement under which rebel fighters were supposed to pull back about 20 kilometres from a demilitarised buffer zone. Now, that agreement never really took hold, and we've seen the situation very much unravel. At the moment, we've had no response yet from the rebels to these reports of a ceasefire tonight. There has been some reaction from the Syrian government's Russian allies. They've welcomed the talk of a ceasefire, but they've expressed doubt that the rebel fighters would go along with the sort of demands that Damascus is making, namely that pulling back from the frontline areas.
So a lot of this will hinge on the reaction of the rebel fighters. What could we anticipate their reaction to be?
Well, as I say, we don't know yet how engaged they have been with this process. It is difficult to believe that those jihadi forces that control so much of Idlib province will be entirely on board with making the kind of withdrawal that Damascus wants to see. Having said that, nowhere in the world needs a break quite like Idlib province. There has been appalling fighting there over the last 3 months. We've seen almost every day civilian casualties as Russian and Syrian Air Force jets have launched attacks. UN tells us something in the region of 500 civilians have been killed. Hundreds of thousands more have been forced from their home. And everybody watching this will welcome any talk at all of a ceasefire. But I think there is going to be a fair bit of scepticism that this can be made to hold. A lot of people will just be hoping for the best, I think.
Alan Johnston. Health workers have confirmed a fourth case of Ebola in the city of Goma in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The latest infection was announced by the World Health Organization a year to the day since the outbreak began. The disease has since killed more than 1,800 people, the country's deadliest ever outbreak. The WHO said that to control the epidemic, more had to be done to prevent infected people from going into hiding. And aid agencies have appealed for borders to be kept open after Rwanda briefly closed the main crossing near Goma. Our correspondent Anne Soy has been following the latest developments.
Goma is a major transport and commercial hub on Congo's border with Rwanda. The Rwandan government said it was closing two crossings into the area to stop the spread of the disease. Traders like Ernest Muvuyekure were left stranded.
Yes, Ebola is a terrible thing, but living is what matters most. I'm more afraid of hunger than of Ebola. They shouldn't close the border. I would rather die of illness than of hunger.
Hours later, Rwanda revoked the decision. It came after a number of aid organizations said closing the border was counterproductive because it would encourage illegal crossings where people wouldn't get checked for the virus. Tamba Emmanuel Ndambisa, who works for Oxfam on the Rwandan side, says closing the border would increase resentment.
People are also dependent on cross-border trade, and if this lifeline is cut off, it would only generate more anger and distrust towards Ebola response, and this will not help the situation at all.
More than 1,800 people have died since the outbreak began in rural areas of the Democratic Republic of Congo a year ago. there is now the risk that it could spread among Goma's 2 million residents and also to other countries, despite efforts to stop the virus.
Rebecca Kesby spoke to David Gressley, the UN's Ebola Emergency Response Coordinator. She asked him first about that decision to briefly close the border with Rwanda.
Frankly, it's because it's a better way to maintain control. If you close the border post, what happens is that people find alternate ways to get around it. And then the whole thing goes underground and becomes even more difficult to track. So it's in everybody's interest to keep the border open and have proper health controls to make sure that someone who's infected can be identified and then given treatment. So it's just more logical.
So we're now a year into this particular outbreak, and there's been a massive effort in the DRC to try and contain it. But there are so many complications, aren't there? There's a very mobile population in the region. It's a conflict area. Is it possible to contain this virus?
Well, absolutely. It's very difficult, but that doesn't mean you cannot do it. I can easily see a path to do that, but it's going to take a lot of hard work. You have to overcome all the interruptions that we've seen in the past. That's been a major impediment. Interruptions due to armed conflict, attacks on centers, armed attack on cities in which workers have been trying to carry out the response, strikes, political demonstrations. These are all factors that really hinder the response. So stopping those interruptions is important. Secondly, it's a big area. It's a very populous area. There are areas where we still remain blind, actually, because the surveillance is not to the level required. So we need to fill that kind of surveillance gap and increase the quality of contact tracing so that we can identify those who might be infected with the Ebola and then monitor their health so that we can get them treated to receive care as soon as they start to show symptoms. It's actually quite simple. In practice, it can be difficult because of the interruptions, and the difficulty of terrain and things of that nature.
And of course, we've seen over the course of this past year some pretty good breakthroughs in terms of treatment and also a vaccine, which now it seems is around 99% effective. But it's getting people to take that vaccine or getting that vaccine to the people that need it, I suppose, which is another problem.
Well, about 95% of the people who are offered the vaccine actually accept it. So it's got a pretty high acceptance rate, but still 5% is a good number of people that are still vulnerable. So we need to continue to work to provide more information so people can make an informed decision on whether to accept the vaccine. But probably even more important is strengthening the contact identification and tracing so that we get everybody who's a potential contact a chance to be vaccinated.
David Gressley, the UN's Ebola Emergency Response Coordinator. To Zimbabwe now, where an energy crisis is literally turning night into day for many of the country's industrial companies and homes. As daily life for many Zimbabweans worsens, electricity prices are about to catapult at a time when power cuts are getting worse and the price of fuel continues to creep up. And the list goes on. Basic medicines have become too expensive for many citizens, and the government has said food aid is urgently needed for rural communities following a drought. Addressing Parliament on Thursday, the Zimbabwean Finance Minister Mthuli Ncube appealed to international investors to help solve the country's debt crisis. For more on the situation in the country, I spoke to our reporter, Shinga Nyoka, who is in the capital, Harare.
Well, it's a huge challenge and everyone is affected, the rich, the middle class and the poor. There's no power in most parts of the country between 5 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night. And so people are having to improvise. They've had to change their schedules, wake up at about 11 o'clock at night to do their cooking, to do their ironing. And so it's a huge challenge for Zimbabweans to cope with this.
And it's not just the residential areas, is it? There have been electricity cuts in the past 24 hours hitting industry too.
Well, what we've seen over the last 2 months since these rolling blackouts were implemented is that in the central business district, there was electricity for most of the time and also in some of the industries in the outlying areas. But we've also seen a rolling blackouts there. And those who have some money, those who are able to find fuel, because there's also a fuel shortage, are having to power generators. And so this has had a huge impact on the economy. And that's one of the issues that the Minister of Finance has raised in his midterm budget statement is that the economy is likely to shrink because of the fuel shortages, the power shortages as well.
Shingai, the government says food aid is needed in villages, basic medicines are, by several accounts, unaffordable for many. Are we on the verge of a national crisis?
The government is blaming the drought. We've had the worst rainfall in the last 20 years or so. 5.5 million people need food aid in a country with a population of 14 million. But people would say that this is the worst crisis the country has had in the last 10 years. And there are also whispers that perhaps under Robert Mugabe, the economy was in a better state and that Zimbabweans haven't suffered as much as they are now under a new government.
Back in January, there were protests that lasted a few days. How are people responding now to hikes in fuel, electricity and this generally worsening situation?
The responses have been subdued compared to what we saw in January, where close to a dozen people were killed in those fuel protests. Since then, the fuel has gone up almost fivefold. Civil society, as well as the opposition and trade unions, are threatening to protest, but they haven't done so yet. I think there's just a realization that things will get worse, but there really is general discontent across the country with Emmerson Mnangagwa's government, and all indications are that things will get a lot worse before they get better.
Shingai Nyoka with that assessment from Zimbabwe. Still to come in the podcast.
It was last Thursday that the light aircraft took off from a remote airstrip in the north of Madagascar.
Police in Madagascar say they're investigating why a Cambridge University student fell to her death after opening the door of a small plane in midair. India's ruling BJP party has expelled a state lawmaker, Kuldeep Sengar, who is charged with the rape of a 19-year-old woman. The move comes in the wake of a car crash on Sunday that critically injured the alleged victim and her lawyer and killed her two aunts. The teenager's family has accused Mr. Sengar of organising the crash to silence her. After widespread outrage, the country's top court has ordered that the rape case be transferred to Delhi and the trial be completed within 45 days. The BBC's Divya Arya sent this report from Lucknow.
I'm outside the government hospital in Lucknow, where the victim is being treated with the help of life support. Opposition lawmakers and the family allege that this accident was in fact a conspiracy to eliminate her. Mr. Sengar denies all allegations. Now, the family also says that they wrote to the Chief Justice of India just a few days before the car crash about receiving death threats. The top court today took cognizance of that letter, heard what they were saying, and passed orders to speed up the investigation. The mother of the victim told the BBC that she is happy that Mr. Sengar has been expelled. She said, finally, there is some good news. She has been camping here, worried for her daughter's health, which has not shown any signs of improvement so far.
They have not allowed me to see my daughter for the past 2 days. When I saw her last, she wasn't speaking, so who knows if she'll get better or not. I cannot give up her battle for justice.
Mr. Sengar was charged under India's stringent child protection laws as the teenager was a minor in 2017. These laws provide for speedy trial, but even a year after Mr. Sengar's arrest, the trial is yet to begin. Now, with the top court's orders for day-to-day hearings, the victim's family is hopeful that their wait for justice may soon be over.
That report by Divya Arya in Lucknow. Police in Madagascar say they're investigating why a Cambridge University student fell to her death after opening the door of a small plane in midair. Alana Cutland, who was 19 and from Milton Keynes in southern England, had been on an internship on the African island when she died last week. Our correspondent Andrew Harding sent this report from Johannesburg.
It was last Thursday that the light aircraft took off from a remote airstrip in the north of Madagascar. A few minutes later, the plane's side door was opened, and soon after that, 19-year-old Alana Cutland fell to her death. Today, a police colonel, Jaffi Sambatra Ravoavi, told the BBC that it was Alana herself who opened that door. Why she did that is not yet clear. Her family have asked for privacy as they mourn. The police in Madagascar say they have not ruled out suicide. They've also confirmed that they are investigating the possibility, only a possibility at this stage, that Alana had had some sort of extreme reaction to drugs she might have taken to ward off malaria. At least two other people, the pilot and another woman, were on the flight. A local police official has been quoted by some newspapers describing a struggle on the plane soon after the door was opened. The Cambridge student's body has not yet been found. She'd travelled to Madagascar on her summer holiday to help with a research project, but had reportedly decided to return home early. Her family from Milton Keynes have described her as a bright, independent woman.
Andrew Harding. The American rapper ASAP Rocky has been giving his account of a fight in Sweden where he's been accused of assaulting a 19-year-old man. The artist, whose real name is Rakim Mayers, and two members of his entourage have pleaded not guilty to the charge. The case has drawn widespread interest, including from President Trump, who has previously called for the rapper's release. Maddie Savage has been following the trial in Stockholm.
The US rapper appeared calm throughout more than 2 hours of questioning, speaking just a few sentences at a time so they could be easily translated into Swedish by an interpreter. He was watched from the public gallery by his mother, who was sitting close to Robert O'Brien, the diplomat called in by President Trump to follow the trial. ASAP Rocky said that he and his entourage had been trying to use an app to book an electric scooter back to their hotel when they were approached by the alleged victim, who repeatedly refused to leave the scene despite intervention from the rapper's bodyguard. The star made a point of describing his celebrity status in the US, which he said meant he'd been attacked and robbed in the past and made him wary of strangers that he believed to be scary. He admitted punching and shoving the alleged victim in self-defense.
I intervened and I threw Jafari to the ground and I stepped on his arm. I kicked his arm.
But he denied the prosecution's central claim that he used a glass bottle in the fight.
As far as the bottles go, I held it momentarily because I realized it was stupid, especially when they didn't have it in their possession. It wasn't necessary for me to have it, so I put it down.
If the rapper's found innocent, he could claim damages for more than $1 million in lost earnings. But he told the court he was looking for justice, not compensation. If ASAP Rocky is found guilty, he could face up to 2 years in prison.
Maddie Savage in Sweden. A judge in Portugal has ruled that the former president of Sporting Lisbon, one of the country's biggest football clubs, will face trial for allegedly ordering a violent attack on his own players at the club's training ground. From Lisbon, here's Alison Roberts.
On May 15th last year, after a string of poor results for Sporting, around 50 self-styled fans of the Lisbon club burst into a changing room at its training complex and beat players and coaches with belts and fists. The intruders were wearing hoods, but police ultimately charged 44 people, including the club's president, Bruno de Carvalho, who was suspected of ordering the attack. Now, after a pre-trial hearing, a judge has ruled that the case should go to court, with charges including physical assault, kidnapping, criminal damage and possession of an illegal weapon. In the wake of last year's incident, Mr. Carvalho was voted out by members. He continues to deny all knowledge of the incident.
Alison Roberts in Portugal. It's been a memorable day for the British teenager Khadija Mela.
Khadija Mela now coming through to Khan, take up the running. Can she push this out to victory? Rachel Gowland, though, pressing her very hard on the line. It's a photo between the two of them. Rachel Gowland, and win, lose or draw, the 18-year-old from Brixton, Khadija Mela, has had the race of her life, forcing a photo finish in the Magnolia Cup.
And after that photo finish, it was confirmed that Khadija was indeed the winner, meaning she made history, becoming the first British horse rider to compete whilst wearing the hijab at the Glorious Goodwood charity race. Khadija first sat on a racecourse, incredibly, just 4 months ago, but hopes her win will inspire a new generation of women to join her.
There are no words to describe it. I can't believe it, to be fair. I'm still sort of trying to figure out how the hell that happened. And I'm just so glad that everyone's here to support. And I'm so happy that Haviland did well and he's okay. It was amazing. When we were going around in the circles and I was like trying to like get everyone to sort of like start talking because it was dead silent. And I was like, oh my God, like everyone smiled or something. I don't know. I didn't really know what to do. It was just everyone was like on the ball at the start. And we set off and there was three horses in the line in front of me, like sort of like a brick wall. And they were just like the kickback was flying in my face and I was like, I don't know what to do, let's just pull out and see what happens. Ambitious women can make it, and that's all I want to like sort of represent, like be ambitious and do it, you know. And I've had so much support, and like I can't wait to see other stories of other women doing the same and sort of like getting into the industry and doing amazing.
An enthusiastic Khadija Mela there. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Mark Lobel. Until next time, goodbye.